Chapter 2. The Magic in Food. For days, the Fox clan had been gathering and storing unusually large amounts of food. Strips of gazelle meat had been smoked to a uniform darkness, while the clan children had gathered sweet grass corms and insect pupas. And the women had amassed eggs, the largest number ever. These eggs preoccupied Lammy, who was careful to attend to the task before her. After all, was she not the daughter of the mistress of all birds? The eggs had to be carefully stacked in open wicker baskets and transported on the heads of some of the more responsible girls. The food trading ritual would take place when the people of the Fox Clan, Lammy's people, met the Hawk people, the mysterious dwellers in the land of sandstone pinnacles. This very day they would join those others, as they had each year for time untellable, for the great festival dances and the food exchange. Lammy recalled the last gathering of her sib, when Venda, the most cycles shaman of the Fox people, had proclaimed the festival and its motivation. "To share food is to be of one body. As the Hawk clan eats of our food, they become as we are. As we eat of their food, we become them. Through eating the food of the others, we remain as one." With her shriveled breasts and bent back, Venda seemed ancient to Lammy. Whatever her age, no one remembered more than she, and her word was rarely questioned within the group. Lammy gently hoisted her burden for the trek. If the Hawk people wanted eggs, then eggs they would have. The ways in which humans use plants, foods, and drugs cause the values of individuals and ultimately whole societies to shift. Eating some foods makes us happy, eating others sleepy and still others alert. We are jovial, restless, aroused, or depressed depending on what we have eaten. Society tacitly encourages certain behaviors that correspond to internal feelings, thereby encouraging the use of substances that produce acceptable behaviors. Suppression or expression of sexuality, fertility and sexual potency, degree of visual acuity, sensitivity to sound, speed of motor response, rate of maturation, and lifespan. These are only some of an animal's characteristics that can be influenced by food plants with exotic chemistries. Human symbol formation, linguistic facility, and sensitivity to community values may also shift under the influence of psychoactive and physiologically active metabolites. A night spent observing behavior in a singles bar should be fieldwork enough to confirm this observation. Indeed, the mate-getting hustle has always placed a high premium on linguistic facility, as perennial attention to patter styles and opening lines attests. When thinking about drugs, we tend to focus on episodes of intoxication, but many drugs are normally used in sub-threshold or maintenance doses. Coffee and tobacco are obvious examples in our culture. The result of this is a kind of ambiance of intoxication. Like fish and water, people in a culture swim in the virtually invisible medium of culturally sanctioned, yet artificial states of mind. Languages appear invisible to the people who speak them, yet they create the fabric of reality for their users. The problem of mistaking language for reality in the everyday world is only too well known. Plant use is an example of a complex language of chemical and social interactions. Yet most of us are unaware of the effect of plants on ourselves and our reality, partly because we have forgotten that plants have always mediated the human cultural relationship to the world at large. A Shaggy Primate Story. At Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania, primatologists found that one particular species of leaf kept appearing undigested in chimpanzee dung. They found that every few days the chimps, instead of eating wild fruit as usual, would walk for 20 minutes or more to a site where a species of espalier grew. The chimps would repeatedly place their lips over an espalier leaf and hold it in their mouths. They would pluck a leaf, place it in their mouths, roll it around for a few moments, then swallow it whole. In this way, as many as 30 small leaves might be eaten. Biochemist Eloy Rodriguez of the University of California at Irvine isolated the active principle from the espalier, a reddish oil now named thiorubrin A. Neil Towers of the University of British Columbia found that this compound can kill common bacteria in concentrations of less than one part per million. Herbarium records studied by Rodriguez and Tower showed that African peoples used espalier leaves to treat wounds and stomach aches. Of the four species native to Africa, the indigenous peoples used only three, the same three species used by the chimpanzees. Rodriguez and Towers have continued their observations of chimp and plant interactions and can now identify nearly a dozen plants, a veritable materia medica in use among chimpanzee populations. You are what you eat. Our proposed story of human emergence into the light of self-reflection is a you-are-what-you-eat story. Major climatic change and a newly broadened and hence mutagenic diet provided many opportunities for natural selection to affect the evolution of major human traits. Each encounter with a new food, drug, or flavoring was fraught with risk and unpredictable consequences. And this is even more true today, when our food contains hundreds of poorly studied preservatives and additives. As an example of plants with a potential impact on a human population, consider sweet potatoes of the genus Dioscorea. In much of the tropical world, sweet potatoes provide a reliable and nutritious source of food. Nevertheless, several closely related species contain compounds that can interfere with ovulation. These have become the source of raw materials for modern birth control pills. Something close to genetic chaos would descend on a population of primates that settled into feeding upon these species of Dioscorea. Many such scenarios, though of a less spectacular magnitude, must have occurred as early hominids experimented with new foods while expanding their omnivorous dietary habits. Eating a plant or an animal is a way of claiming its power, a way of assimilating its magic to oneself. In the minds of pre-literate people, the lines between drugs, foods, and spices are rarely clearly drawn. The shaman who gorges himself on chili peppers to raise inner heat is hardly in a less altered state than the nitrous oxide enthusiast after a long inhalation. In our perception of flavor and our pursuit of variety in the sensation of eating, we are markedly different from even our primate cousins. Somewhere along the line, our new omnivorous eating habits and our evolving brain with its capacity to process sensory data were united in the happy notion that food can be experience. Gastronomy was born to join pharmacology, which must surely have preceded it, since maintenance of health through regulation of diet is seen among many animals. The strategy of the early hominid omnivores was to eat everything that seemed food-like and to vomit whatever was unpalatable. Plants, insects, and small animals found edible by this method were then inculcated into their diet. A changing diet or an omnivorous diet means exposure to an ever-shifting chemical equilibrium. An organism may regulate this chemical input through internal processes, but ultimately, mutagenic influences will increase, and a greater than usual number of genetically variant individuals will be offered up to the process of natural selection. The results of this natural selection are accelerated changes in neural organization, states of consciousness, and behavior. No change is permanent, each gives way to yet another. All flows. Symbiosis. As plants influence the development of humans and other animals, so are the plants themselves affected in turn. This coevolution invokes the idea of symbiosis. Symbiosis has several meanings. I use it to mean a relationship between two species that confers mutual benefit upon their members. The biological and evolutionary success of each species is linked to and enhanced by that of the other. This situation is the opposite of parasitism, though happy is the parasite that can evolve into a symbiont. Symbiotic relationships, in which each member requires the other, can be very tightly bound genetically, or the linkage can be somewhat more open. While human-plant interactions were symbiotic in their pattern of mutual gain and advantage, these relationships were not genetically programmed. They are clearly seen instead as deep habits when contrasted with examples of true symbiosis from the world of nature. One example of a genetically bound and hence truly symbiotic relationship involves the small clown anemone fish, Amphiprion oscillaris, which spends its life in the proximity of certain species of sea anemones. These clownfish are protected from larger predators by the anemones, and the anemone's food supply is expanded by the clownfish, which attract larger fish into the area where the anemone is feeding. When such a mutually agreeable arrangement is in place for a long time, it will eventually institutionalize itself by progressively blurring the clear genetic distinction between the symbionts. Ultimately, one organism may actually become a part of the other, much in the way that mitochondria, the powerhouses of the animal cell, joined with other structures to form the cell. Mitochondria have a separate genetic component, whose ancestry can be traced to free-swimming eukaryotic bacteria, which once hundreds of millions of years ago were independent organisms. Another instance of symbiosis that is instructive and that may have deep implications for our own situation is the relationship that has evolved between leafcutter ants and a species of basidiomycete, a mushroom. E.O. Wilson discusses this relationship. At the end of the trail, the burdened foragers rush down the nest hole, into throngs of nestmates and along tortuous channels that end near the water table 15 feet or more below. The ants drop the leaf sections onto the floor of a chamber, to be picked up by workers of a slightly smaller size, who clip them into fragments about a millimeter across. Within minutes, still smaller ants take over, crush and mold the fragments into moist pellets, and carefully insert them into a mass of similar material. This mass ranges in size between a clenched fist and a human head, is riddled with channels, and resembles a gray cleaning sponge. It is the garden of the ants. On its surface, a symbiotic fungus grows which, along with the leaf sap, forms the ant's sole nourishment. The fungus spreads like a white frost, sinking its hyphae into the leaf paste to digest the abundant cellulose and proteins held there in partial solution. The gardening cycle proceeds. Worker ants even smaller than those just described pluck loose those strands of the fungus from places of dense growth and plant them onto the newly constructed surfaces. Finally, the very smallest and most abundant workers patrol the beds of fungal strands, delicately probing them with their antennae, licking their surfaces clean, and plucking out the spores and hyphae of alien species of mold. These colony dwarfs are able to travel through the narrowest channels deep within the garden masses. From time to time, they pull tufts of fungus loose and carry them out to their larger nestmates. No other animals have evolved the ability to turn fresh vegetation into mushrooms. The evolutionary event occurred only once, millions of years ago, somewhere in South America. It gave the ants an enormous advantage. They could now send out specialized workers to collect the vegetation while keeping the bulk of their population safe in subterranean retreats. As a result, all of the different kinds of leafcutters together, comprising 14 species in the genus Atta and 23 in Acromyrmex, dominate a large part of the American tropics. They consume more vegetation than any other group of animals, including the more abundant forms of caterpillars, grasshoppers, birds, and mammals. We can forgive E.O. Wilson, the foremost exponent of sociobiology, for thinking that an animal and a mushroom formed a mutually beneficial relationship only once in the history of the Earth. His description of leafcutter ant society and its relationship to fungal agriculture anticipates and introduces central considerations in my effort to revision our own complex relationship to plants. For, as we shall see, a byproduct of the lifestyle of the nomadic human pastoralist was the increased availability and use of psychoactive fungi. Like the agricultural activities of the ants, the behavior patterns of nomadic human society served as an effective way for mushrooms to expand their range. A new view of human evolution. The first encounters between hominids and psilocybin-containing mushrooms may have predated the domestication of cattle in Africa by a million years or more. And during this million-year period, the mushrooms were not only gathered and eaten, but probably also achieved the status of a cult. But domestication of wild cattle, a great step in human cultural evolution, by bringing humans into greater proximity to cattle, also entailed increased contact with the mushrooms, because these mushrooms grow only in the dung of cattle. As a result, the human-mushroom interspecies codependency was enhanced and deepened. It was at this time that religious ritual, calendar-making, and natural magic came into their own. Shortly after humans encountered the visionary fungi of the African grasslands, and like the leafcutter ants, we too became the dominant species of our area, and we too learned ways of keeping the bulk of our population safe in subterranean retreats. In our case, these retreats were walled cities. In pondering the course of human evolution, some thoughtful observers have questioned the scenario that physical anthropologists present us. Evolution in higher animals takes a long time to occur, operating in time spans of rarely less than a million years, and more often, in tens of millions of years. But the emergence of modern humans from the higher primates, with the enormous changes affected in brain size and behavior, transpired in fewer than 3 million years. Physically, in the last 100,000 years, we have apparently changed very little, but the amazing proliferation of cultures, social institutions, and linguistic systems, has come so quickly that modern evolutionary biologists can scarcely account for it. Most do not even attempt an explanation. Indeed, the absence of a theoretical model is not surprising. There's much that we do not know about the complex situation prevailing among the hominids just prior to and during the time when modern human beings were emerging onto the scene. Biological and fossil evidence clearly indicates that man is descended from primate ancestors, not radically different from primate species still extant, and yet Homo sapiens obviously isn't a class apart from other members of the order. Thinking about human evolution ultimately means thinking about the evolution of human consciousness. What, then, are the origins of the human mind? In their explanations, some investigators have adopted a primarily cultural emphasis. They point to our unique linguistic and symbolical capabilities, our use of tools, and our ability to store information epigenetically as songs, art, books, computers, thereby creating not only culture, but also history. Others, taking a somewhat more biological approach, have emphasized our physiological and neurological peculiarities, including the exceptionally large size and complexity of the human neocortex, a great proportion of which is devoted to complex linguistic processing, storage, and retrieval of information, as well as being associated with motor systems governing activities like speech and writing. More recently, the feedback interactions between cultural influence and biological ontogeny have been recognized and seen to be involved in certain human developmental oddities, such as prolonged childhood and adolescence, the delayed onset of sexual maturity, and the persistence of many essentially neonatal characteristics through adult life. Unfortunately, the union of these points of view has not yet led to the recognition of the genome-shaping power of psychoactive and physioactive dietary constituents. By 3 million years ago, and through a combination of the processes just discussed, at least 3 clearly recognized species of proto-hominids were in place in East Africa. These were Homo africanus, Homo boisei, and Homo robustus. Also at that time, the omnivorous Homo habilis, the first true hominid, had clearly emerged from a division of species that also gave rise to 2 vegetarian man-apes. The grasslands expanded slowly. Early hominids moved through a mosaic of grasslands and forests. These creatures, with brains proportionately only slightly larger than chimpanzees, were already walking upright and probably carrying food and tools between patches of forest, which they continued to exploit for tubers and insects. Their arms were proportionately longer than ours, and they possessed a more powerful grasping hand. The evolution to upright posture and the initial expansion into a grassland niche had occurred earlier, between 9 and 5 million years ago. Unfortunately, we lack fossil evidence for this earlier transition. The hominids likely expanded their original diet of fruit and small animal kills by including underground roots, tubers, and corms. A simple digging stick would allow access to this previously untapped food source. Modern baboons on the savanna subsist largely on grass corms during certain seasons. Chimpanzees add substantial amounts of beans to their diet when they venture onto the savanna. Both baboons and chimpanzees hunt cooperatively and prey on small animals. They do not generally use tools in hunting, however, and there is no evidence that early hominids did either. Among chimps, baboons, and hominids, hunting appears to be a male activity. Early hominids hunted both cooperatively and alone. With Homo habilis began a sudden and mysterious expansion of brain size. Homo habilis's brain weighed an average 770 grams, 27.5 ounces, compared with 530 grams, 19 ounces for competing hominids. The next 2.25 million years brought an unusually rapid evolution in brain size and complexity. By 750,000 to 1.1 million years ago, a new hominid type, Homo erectus, was widespread. The brain size of this new hominid was 900 to 1100 grams, 2.24 pounds. Evidence is good that Homo erectus used tools and possessed some sort of rudimentary culture. At Joko Tien Cave in South Africa, there is good evidence of fire use along with burnt bones indicating the cooking of meat. These are attributed to Homo erectus, which was the earliest hominid to leave Africa 1 million or so years ago. Older theory suggests that modern humans evolved from Homo erectus in different locales. Increasingly, however, modern evolutionary primatologists accept the notion that modern Homo sapiens also arose in Africa, some 100,000 years ago, and made a second great outward migration from there to people the entire planet. At Border Cave and the Klazis Rivermouth Cave in South Africa, there is evidence of the earliest modern Homo sapiens living in a mixed forest and grassland environment. In one of many attempts to understand this momentous transition, Charles J. Lumsden and Edward O. Wilson wrote, "Behavioral ecologists have gradually assembled a theory to explain why the advance to an erect posture was taken, one that accounts for many of the most distinctive biological traits of modern man. The earliest man-apes shifted out of the tropical evergreen forest into more open seasonal habitats, where they became committed to an exclusively terrestrial existence. They constructed base camps and became dependent on a division of labor by which some individuals, probably the females, wandered less and devoted more time to the care of the young. Others, primarily or exclusively the males, dispersed widely in the search for animal prey. Bipedalism conferred a great advantage in open country locomotion. It also freed the arms, permitting the ancestral man-apes to use tools and to carry dead animals and other food back to the base camp. Food sharing and related forms of reciprocity automatically followed as central processes of the social life of the man-apes. So did close long-term sexual bonding and heightened sexuality, which were put to the service of rearing the young. Many of the most distinctive forms of human social behavior are the product of this tightly interwoven complex of adaptation. One advanced hominid type followed another in the African evolutionary laboratory, and beginning with Homo erectus, representatives of each type radiated across the Eurasian landmass in the interglacial periods. During each glaciation, migration out of Africa was bottled up. New hominids were cooked in the African ambiance of intensified forces of mutation from exotic diets and climatically induced increased natural selection. At the end of these truly remarkable 3 million years in the evolution of the human species, human brain size had tripled. Lumsden and Wilson call this, perhaps the fastest advance recorded for any complex organ in the whole history of life. Such a remarkable rate of evolutionary change in the primary organ of a species implies the presence of extraordinary selective pressures. Because scientists were unable to explain this tripling of the human brain size in so short a span of evolutionary time, some of the early primate paleontologists and evolutionary theorists predicted and searched for evidence of transitional skeletons. Today, the idea of a missing link has largely been abandoned. Bipedalism, binocular vision, the opposable thumb, the throwing arm, all have been put forth as the key ingredient in the mix that caused self-reflecting humans to crystallize out of the cauldron of competing hominid types and strategies. Yet all we really know is that the shift in brain size was accompanied by remarkable changes in the social organization of the hominids. They became users of tools, fire, and language. They began the process as higher animals and emerged from it 100,000 years ago as conscious, self-aware individuals. The real missing link. My contention is that mutation-causing psychoactive chemical compounds in the early human diet directly influence the rapid reorganization of the brain's information processing capabilities. Alkaloids in plants, specifically the hallucinogenic compounds such as psilocybin, dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and harmaline, could be the chemical factors in the proto-human diet that catalyze the emergence of human self-reflection. The action of hallucinogens present in many common plants enhanced our information processing activity, or environmental sensitivity, and thus contributed to the sudden expansion of the human brain size. At a later stage in this same process, hallucinogens acted as catalysts in the development of imagination, fueling the creation of internal stratagems and hopes that may well have synergized the emergence of language and religion. In research done in the late 1960s, Roland Fisher gave small amounts of psilocybin to graduate students and then measured their ability to detect the moment when previously parallel lines became skewed. He found that performance ability on this particular task was actually improved after small doses of psilocybin. When I discussed these findings with Fisher, he smiled after explaining his conclusions, then summed up, "You see, what is conclusively proven here is that under certain circumstances, one is actually better informed concerning the real world if one has taken a drug than if one has not." His facetious remark stuck with me. First as an academic anecdote, later as an effort on his part to communicate something profound. What would be the consequences for evolutionary theory of admitting that some chemical habits confer adaptive advantage and thereby become deeply scripted in the behavior and even genome of some individuals? Three big steps for the human race. In trying to answer that question, I have constructed a scenario. Some may call it fantasy. It is the world as seen from the vantage point of a mind for which the millennia are but seasons, a vision that years of musing on these matters has moved me toward. Let us imagine for a moment that we stand outside the surging gene swarm that is biological history, and that we can see the interwoven consequences of changes in diet and climate, which must certainly have been too slow to be felt by our ancestors. The scenario that unfolds involves the interconnected and mutually reinforcing effects of psilocybin, taken at three different levels. Unique in its properties, psilocybin is the only substance I believe that could yield this scenario. At the first, low level of usage is the effect that Fisher noted. Small amounts of psilocybin, consumed with no awareness of its psychoactivity, while in the general act of browsing for food, and perhaps later consumed consciously, impart a noticeable increase in visual acuity, especially edge detection. As visual acuity is at a premium among hunter-gatherers, the discovery of the equivalent of chemical binoculars could not fail to have an impact on the hunting and gathering success of those individuals who availed themselves of this advantage. Partnership groups containing individuals with improved eyesight will be more successful at feeding their offspring. Because of the increase in available food, the offspring within such groups will have a higher probability of themselves reaching reproductive age. In such a situation, the outbreeding or decline of non-psilocybin-using groups would be a natural consequence. Because psilocybin is a stimulant of the central nervous system, when taken in slightly larger doses, it tends to trigger restlessness and sexual arousal. Thus, at this second level of usage, by increasing instances of copulation, the mushrooms directly favored human reproduction. The tendency to regulate and schedule sexual activity within the group, by linking it to a lunar cycle of mushroom availability, may have been important as a first step toward ritual and religion. Certainly at the third and highest level of usage, religious concerns would be at the forefront of the tribe's consciousness, simply because of the power and strangeness of the experience itself. This third level, then, is the level of the full-blown shamanic ecstasy. The psilocybin intoxication is a rapture whose breadth and depth is the despair of prose. It is wholly other and no less mysterious to us than it was to our mushroom-munching ancestors. The boundary-dissolving qualities of shamanic ecstasy predispose hallucinogen-using tribal groups to community bonding and to group sexual activities, which promote gene mixing, higher birth rates, and a communal sense of responsibility for the group offspring. At whatever dose the mushroom was used, it possessed the magical property of conferring adaptive advantages upon its archaic users and their group. Increased visual acuity, sexual arousal, and access to the transcendent other led to success in obtaining food, sexual prowess and stamina, abundance of offspring, and access to realms of supernatural power. All of these advantages can be easily self-regulated through manipulation of dosage and frequency of ingestion. Chapter 4 will detail psilocybin's remarkable property of stimulating the language-forming capacity of the brain. Its power is so extraordinary that psilocybin can be considered the catalyst to the human development of language. Steering clear of Lamarck. An objection to these ideas inevitably rises and should be dealt with. This scenario of human emergence may seem to smack of Lamarckism, which theorizes that characteristics acquired by an organism during its lifetime could be passed on to its progeny. The classic example is the claim that giraffes have long necks because they stretch their necks to reach high branches. This straightforward and rather common-sense idea is absolutely anathema among neo-Darwinians, who currently hold the high ground in evolutionary theory. Their position is that mutations are entirely random, and that only after the mutations are expressed as the traits of organisms does natural selection mindlessly and dispassionately fulfill its function of preserving those individuals upon whom an adaptive advantage had been conferred. Their objection can be put like this. While the mushrooms may have given us better eyesight, sex, and language when eaten, how did these enhancements get into the human genome and become innately human? Non-genetic enhancements of an organism's functioning made by outside agents retard the corresponding genetic reservoirs of those facilities by rendering them superfluous. In other words, if a necessary metabolite is common in available food, there will not be pressure to develop a trait for endogenous expression of the metabolite. Mushroom use would thus create individuals with less visual acuity, language facility, and consciousness. Nature would not provide those enhancements through organic evolution because the metabolic investment required to sustain them wouldn't pay off, relative to the tiny metabolic investment required to eat mushrooms. And yet today we all have these enhancements without taking mushrooms. So how did the mushroom modifications get into the genome? The short answer to this objection, one that requires no defense of Lamarck's ideas, is that the presence of psilocybin in the hominid diet changed the parameters of the process of natural selection by changing the behavioral patterns upon which that selection was operating. Experimentation with many types of foods was causing a general increase in the number of random mutations being offered up to the process of natural selection, while the augmentation of visual acuity, language use, and ritual activity through the use of psilocybin represented new behaviors. One of these new behaviors, language use, previously only a marginally important trait, was suddenly very useful in the context of new hunting and gathering lifestyles. And psilocybin inclusion in the diet shifted the parameters of human behavior in favor of patterns of activity that promoted increased language. Acquisition of language led to more vocabulary and an expanded memory capacity. The psilocybin-using individuals evolved epigenetic rules or cultural forms that enabled them to survive and reproduce better than other individuals. Eventually, the more successful epigenetically based styles of behavior spread through the populations along with the genes that reinforce them. In this fashion, the population would evolve genetically and culturally. As for visual acuity, perhaps the widespread need for corrective lenses among modern humans is a legacy of the long period of artificial enhancement of vision through psilocybin use. After all, atrophy of the olfactory abilities of human beings is thought by one school to be a result of a need for hungry omnivores to tolerate strong smells and tastes, perhaps even carrion. Trade-offs of this sort are common in evolution. The suppression of keenness of taste and smell would allow inclusion of foods in the diet that might otherwise be passed over as too strong, or it may indicate something more profound about our evolutionary relationship to diet. My brother Dennis has written, "The apparent atrophy of the human olfactory system may actually represent a functional shift in a set of primitive, externally directed chemoreceptors to an interiorized regulatory function. This function may be related to the control of the human pheromonal system, which is largely under the control of the pineal gland, and which mediates, on a subliminal level, a host of psychosexual and psychosocial interactions between individuals. The pineal tends to suppress gonadal development and the onset of puberty, among other functions, and this mechanism may play a role in the persistence of neonatal characteristics in the human species. Delayed maturation and prolonged childhood and adolescence play a critical role in the neurological and psychological development of the individual, since they provide the circumstances which permit the postnatal development of the brain in the early formative years of childhood. The symbolic, cognitive, and linguistic stimuli that the brain experiences during this period are essential to its development and are the factors that make us the unique, conscious, symbol-manipulating, language-using beings that we are. Neuroactive amines and alkaloids in the diet of early primates may have played a role in the biochemical activation of the pineal gland and the resulting adaptations. Acquired tastes. Humans are both attracted and repelled by substances whose taste skirts the edges of acceptability. Foods that are highly spiced or bitter or aromatic arouse strong reactions from us. We say of such a food that one must acquire a taste for it. This is true of food such as soft cheese or pickled eggs, but it is also and even more true of drugs. To recall one's first cigarette or first shot of bourbon is to recall an organism violently rejecting the acquisition of a particular taste. Repetition of exposure seems to be the key to acquiring a taste, which suggests that the process is complex and involves both behavioral and biochemical adaptation. What we are talking about begins to sound strangely like the process of drug addiction. Something foreign to the body is nevertheless repeatedly introduced into it by conscious decision. The body adjusts to the new chemical regimen and then does more than adjust. It accepts the new chemical regimen as right and proper and gives off signals of alarm should the regimen be threatened. These signals may be both psychological and physiological and will be felt whenever the new chemical environment within the body is imperiled for any reason, including a conscious decision to discontinue use of the chemical in question. Among the vast number of chemicals that constitute nature's molecular storehouse, we have been discussing a relatively small number of compounds that interact with the senses and the neurological processing of sensory data. These compounds include all of the psychoactive amines, alkaloids, pheromones, and hallucinogens. Indeed, all compounds that can interact with any of the senses, ranging from taste and smell to vision and hearing, and combinations of all of these. The acquisition of a taste for these compounds, the acquisition of a behaviorally and physiologically reinforced habit, is what defines the basic chemical addiction syndrome. These compounds have the remarkable ability to remind us of both our frailty and our capacity for the magnificent. Drugs, like reality, seem destined to confound those who seek clear boundaries and an easy division of the world into black and white. How we meet the challenge of defining our future relationships to these compounds and to the dimensions of risk and opportunity they offer may say the final word about our potential for survival and evolution as a conscious species.